Chapter 12. The End of the Viracochas. We heard in Chapter 10 that Tiwanaku was originally built as a port on the shores of Lake Titicaca, when that lake was far wider and more than 100 feet deeper than it is today. Vast harbour constructions, piers and dikes, and even dumped cargoes of quarried stone at points beneath the old waterline leave no doubt that this must have been the case. Indeed, according to the unorthodox estimates of Professor Poznanski, Tiwanaku had been in active use as a port as early as 15,000 BC, the date he proposed for the construction of the Kalasasiya, and had continued to serve as such for approximately another 5,000 years, during which great expanse of time its position in relation to the shore of Lake Titicaca hardly changed. Throughout this epoch, the principal harbour of the port city was located several hundred metres southwest of the Kalasasiya, at a site now known as Pumapunku, literally the Puma Gate. Here Poznanski's excavations revealed two artificially dredged docks on either side of a true and magnificent pier or wharf, where hundreds of ships could at the same time take on and unload their heavy burdens. One of the construction blocks from which the pier had been fashioned still lay on site and weighed an estimated 440 tons. Numerous others weighed between 100 and 150 tons. Furthermore, many of the biggest monoliths had clearly been joined to each other by eye-shaped metal clamps. In the whole of South America, I knew, this masonry technique had been found only on Tiwanakan structures. The last time I had seen the characteristic notched depressions which proved its use had been on ruins on the island of Elephantina in the Nile in Upper Egypt. Equally thought-provoking was the appearance of the symbol of the cross on many of these ancient blocks, recurring again and again, particularly at the northern approach to Pumapunku. This symbol always took the same form, a double crucifix with pure, clean lines, perfectly balanced and harmonious, deeply recessed into the hard grey stone. Even according to orthodox historical chronology, these crosses were not less than 1,500 years old. In other words, they had been carved here by a people with absolutely no knowledge of Christianity, a full millennium before the arrival of the first Spanish missionaries on the Altiplano. Where, come to that, had the Christians obtained their crosses? Not only from the shape of the structure to which Jesus Christ was nailed, I thought, but from some much older source as well. Hadn't the ancient Egyptians, for example, used a hieroglyph very like a cross? The Ankh or Crux Ansata, to symbolize life, the breath of life, eternal life itself? Had that symbol originated in Egypt, or had it perhaps occurred elsewhere, earlier still? With such ideas chasing one another around my head, I walked slowly around Pumapunku. The extensive perimeter, which formed a rectangle several hundred feet long, outlined a low, pyramidal hill, much overgrown with tall grass. Dozens and dozens of hulking blocks lay scattered in all directions, tossed like matchsticks, Poznanski argued, in the terrible natural disaster that had overtaken Tiwanaku during the 11th millennium BC. This catastrophe was caused by seismic movements which resulted in an overflow of the waters of Lake Titicaca and in volcanic eruptions. It is also possible that the temporary increase in the level of the lake may have been caused in part by the breaking of the bulwarks on some of the lakes further to the north and situated at a greater altitude, thus releasing the waters, which descended toward Lake Titicaca in onrushing and unrestrainable torrents. Poznanski's evidence that a flood had been the agent of the destruction of Tiwanaku included the discovery of lacustrine flora, Paludistrina culminea and Paludistrina andicola, Anchylus titicanensis, Planorbis titicanensis, etc., mixed in the alluvia with the skeletons of human beings who perished in the cataclysm, and the discovery of various skeletons of Orestius, fish of the family of the present Bogas, in the same alluvia which contained the human remains. In addition, fragments of human and animal skeletons had been found lying in chaotic disorder among wrought stones, utensils, tools, and an endless variety of other things. All of this has been moved, broken, and accumulated in a confused heap. Anyone who would dig a trench here, 2 meters deep, could not deny that the destructive force of water, in combination with brusque movements of the earth, must have accumulated those different kinds of bones, mixing them with pottery, jewels, tools, and utensils. Layers of alluvium cover the whole field of the ruins, and lacustrine sand mixed with shells from Titicaca, decomposed feldspar, and volcanic ashes have accumulated in the places surrounded by the walls. It had been a terrible catastrophe indeed that had overwhelmed Tiwanaku. And if Poznanski was right, it took place more than 12,000 years ago. Thereafter, though the floodwaters subsided, the culture of the Altiplano did not again attain a high point of development, but fell rather into a total and definitive decadence. Struggle and abandonment. This process was hastened by the fact that the earthquakes which had caused Lake Titicaca to engulf Tiwanaku were only the first of many upheavals in the area. These initially resulted in the lake swelling and overflowing its banks, but they soon began to have the opposite effect, slowly reducing Titicaca's depth and surface area. As the years passed, the lake continued to drain inch by inch, marooning the great city, remorselessly separating it from the waters which had previously played such a vital role in its economic life. At the same time, there was evidence that the climate of the Tiwanaku area had become colder and much less favorable for the growing of crops than had previously been the case. So much less favorable that today staples such as maize cannot ripen properly, and even potatoes come out of the ground stunted. Although it was difficult to piece together all the different elements of the complex chain of events that had occurred, it seemed that a period of calm had followed the critical moment of seismic disturbance which had temporarily flooded Tiwanaku. Then, slowly but surely, the climate worsened and became inclement. Finally, there ensued mass emigrations of the Andean peoples towards locations where the struggle for life would not be so arduous. It seems that the highly civilized inhabitants of Tiwanaku, remembered in local traditions as the Viracocha people, had not gone without a struggle. There was puzzling evidence from all over the Altiplano that agricultural experiments of an advanced and scientific nature had been carried out with great ingenuity and dedication to try to compensate for the deterioration of the climate. For example, recent research has demonstrated that astonishingly sophisticated analyses of the chemical compositions of many poisonous high-altitude plants and tubers had been undertaken by somebody in this region in the furthest antiquity. Such analyses, furthermore, had been coupled with the invention of detoxification techniques, which had rendered these otherwise nutritious vegetables harmless and edible. There was as yet no satisfactory explanation for the development of these detoxification processes, admitted David Brauman, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Washington University. Likewise, in the same period, somebody, as yet unidentified by scholarship, went to great lengths to build raised fields on the newly exposed lands that had so recently been under the waters of the lake, a procedure which created characteristic corrugated strips of alternately high and low ground. It was not until the 1960s that the original function of these undulating patterns of earthen platforms and shallow canals was correctly worked out. Still visible today, and known as Waru Waru by the local Indians, they proved to be part of a complex agricultural design, perfected in prehistoric times, which had the ability to outperform modern farming techniques. In recent years, some of the raised fields were reconstructed by archaeologists and agronomists. These experimental plots consistently yielded 3 times more potatoes than even the most productive conventional plots. Likewise, during one particularly cold spell, a severe frost did little damage to the experimental fields. The following year, the crops on the elevated platform survived an equally ruinous drought, then later rode high and dry through a flood that swamped surrounding farmlands. Indeed, this simple but effective agricultural technique invented by a culture so ancient that no one today could even remember its name, had proved such a success in rural Bolivia that it had attracted the attention of governmental and international development agencies and was now under test in several other parts of the world as well. An artificial language. Another possible legacy of Tiwanaku and of the Viracochas lay embedded in the language spoken by the local Aymara Indians, a language regarded by some specialists as the oldest in the world. In the 1980s, Ivan Guzman de Rojas, a Bolivian computer scientist, accidentally demonstrated that Aymara might be not only very ancient, but significantly, that it might be a made-up language, something deliberately and skillfully designed. Of particular note was the seemingly artificial character of its syntax, which was rigidly structured and unambiguous to an extent thought inconceivable in normal organic speech. This synthetic and highly organized structure meant that Aymara could easily be transformed into a computer algorithm to be used to translate one language into another. The Aymara algorithm is used as a bridge language. The language of an original document is translated into Aymara and then into any number of other languages. Was it just coincidence that an apparently artificial language, governed by a computer-friendly syntax, should be spoken today in the environs of Tiwanaku? Or could Aymara be a legacy of the high learning that legend attributed to the Viracochas? If so, what other legacies might there be? What other incomplete fragments of an old and forgotten wisdom might be lying scattered around? Fragments which had perhaps contributed to the richness and diversity of many of the cultures that had evolved in this region during the 10,000 years before the conquest. Perhaps it was the possession of fragments like these that had made possible the drawing of the Nazca lines and enabled the predecessors of the Incas to build the impossible stone walls at Machu Picchu and Sacsayhuaman. Mexico. The image I could not get out of my mind was of the Viracocha people leaving, walking on the waters of the Pacific Ocean, or going miraculously by sea, as so many of the legends told. Where had these seafarers been going? What had their objective been? And why, come to think of it, had they made such dogged efforts to stay in Tiwanaku for so long before admitting defeat and moving on? What had they been trying to achieve there that had been so important to them? After several weeks' work on the Altiplano, traveling back and forth between La Paz and Tiwanaku, it became clear that neither the otherworldly ruins nor the libraries of the capital were going to provide me with any further answers. Indeed, in Bolivia at least, the trail seemed to have gone cold. It was not until I reached Mexico, 2,000 miles to the north, that I picked up its traces again.